Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. Today's episode is brought to you by our friends at NetSuite, and we are joined once again by Stuart Stevens. Now, how do you describe yourself? Yeah, I was going to say political consultant guru, the whisperer to the stars. How would you define yourself?
Very blandly, political consultant and writer.
Political consultant and writer, and I want to talk to you about your book, It Was All a Lie, that's coming out in May. But so you're up in British Columbia today. You've actually left the country. You're in Canada.
I escaped over the border. I'm here really to look for Ted Cruz's birth certificate, but I'm also trying to do a little skiing.
I thought maybe you were doing a little bit of, recon for what I think is now the inevitable war between the United States and Canada. Because I think this country needs something. Justin Trudeau has clearly crossed the line. He's pissed off the president. You know that we have to have a wag the dog. So why the hell not invade Canada again?
I would do it in the summer. The Canadians are very good in the winter. I think it would be best if it was like a July 4th sort of invasion. But, you know, we've tried invading Canada before several times. It's never gone well. They now have Canoe Reeves on their side, Canadian. So I really think it could be a daunting task and shouldn't be rushed into. Don't underestimate the Canadians, you know?
No, I never underestimate the Canadians. So speaking of which, though, let's start off with maybe not the most important story, but on Earth 2.0, we'd probably be talking about it for a lot longer. The president of the United States was basically laughed out of London yesterday, wasn't he?
Yes. When Boris Johnson, who is sort of a ludicrous figure, finds you ludicrous, that's like really not a good sign. I get all this stuff that Republicans say, you know, people don't care about foreign policy. This is going to help Trump and all this. I don't know about that. You know, I mean, one of the things we liked about Ronald Reagan was that he was respected around the world. And nobody laughed at Ronald Reagan after he was president. People sort of scoffed at the idea that an actor, you know, bedtime for Bonzo, could be president. But once he was president, people respected him because he deserved respect. And Donald Trump's now been president for several years, and he's only gotten worse. And the world is laughing at him. And this is not a good thing in any sense.
This is not a good thing.
The world. Yeah. It weakens America. It reduces the stature of the country, which is significant. And it's something that we harked about this with Obama, you know, talking about how he went around the world apologizing for America. And if this was a Democratic president, it would drive us crazy.
Well, and Donald Trump ran basically saying we are the laughingstock of the world and we have to stop people laughing at us. So that's ironic. I thought it was an interesting psychological moment. I mean, first of all, that video that came out, which it actually sounds like a joke. We have the Prime Minister of Great Britain, the Prime Minister of Canada, the President of France, and Princess Anne walk into a bar. I mean, it really looked like that. And they're laughing at what a total goof the President of the United States is. And really, I think it was Maggie Haberman who tweeted out that this is really goes to the real psychological vulnerability of a guy that's always thought of himself as the outsider and really is deep. Deeply offended by the cool kids not accepting him and laughing about him. And sure enough, what does the president do? His feelings are hurt and he cancels his solo press conference and he leaves the NATO summit early. Yeah, really, you know, kind of amazing.
You know, life probably always imitates high school ultimately, but at this level, it's just so transparent. I think a lot of Trumpism is a need to belong. And I see a lot of these, you know, if you look at sort of the oddballs and freaks that Donald Trump has attracted, the Steve Bannons, the Millers, the Gorkas, you know, these are the people that, you know, in college or at the end of the hall killing zombies and talking about how much they hated women. They're just sort of weird people. And Trump is a magnet for them because he validates them. And he validates their sort of anger and bitterness at the world. And Trump himself is this deeply damaged person. He's been this way, you know, probably since 5 years old or earlier. I'll leave that to shrinks. But, you know, his whole attack on coastal elites. I mean, here's a guy who was a millionaire because of a trust fund. By the time he was in high school, he's lived his entire life within walking distance of the Atlantic Ocean, and he's attacking coastal elites. I mean, it's the most ludicrous posturing, and how this is embraced by, you know, what used to be the Republican Party.
Yes,
it's just mind-boggling.
Well, speaking of the misfit toys, and we have, I have a long list of misfit toys I wanted to ask you about. This bizarre story about Rudy Giuliani being back in Ukraine, still digging up dirt, doing a TV show for One America Now Network, which would suggest apparently that even the ongoing impeachment process is not deterring Donald Trump and Rudy Giuliani. I mean, it does occur to me that the strongest case you could make for moving ahead with impeachment right now is in fact that this is an ongoing effort to drop this giant turd bomb into the 2020 campaign.
Look, I mean, I really don't think this isn't unusual in the sense that these are people who think they're above the law and are acting as if they're above the law. We see this, you know, in Mexico. This is how the cartels operate. And the Republican Party really has become a cartel. I mean, why do cartels exist? Cartels exist for the furtherment of whatever their product is. No one asks, what is the purpose of OPEC? What is the moral standing of OPEC? It's to sell oil. No one asks us about drugs. Like, what is the moral purpose of the drug cartel? It's to sell drugs. What is the purpose of the Republican Party? It's to elect Republicans now. There is no higher good that they're pretending to serve. It's just, we're going to get out there. And these are people that are acting like, you know, drug kingpins or OPEC kingpins who are above the law. The little people deal with the law, and they're just going to keep doing what they do. I mean,
so do you no longer consider yourself a Republican?
Well,
I don't know.
You know, it's I have no place in this Republican Party.
So, I mean, really, you're losing out on the opportunity to become part of a political party that boasts Louis Gohmert as one of its elected representatives.
I
really do look at Louis, and I'm thinking that somewhere there is a writer for Saturday Night Live crying softly into their pillow thinking, I can't do this. I can't do it better. I cannot do a parody of Louis Gohmert as the dumbest possible member of Congress.
Yeah, you know, it's when Spy Magazine famously announced the 10 dumbest congressmen and the dumbest held a press conference to deny that he should be first. I always think about when I see him. You know, in the political trade business, we have this phrase, which is not a positive, that such and such person is very congressional. And it's meant in like sort of small time. There's so many people that pop up now as sort of prominent figures in the Republican Party that are just very congressional in the worst way.
That's really good, by the way, because you could use that in front of a congressman and they wouldn't know what you meant. They would think that you would mean, you know.
Yes. How? And it's
how congressional.
You know, the weird thing that just strikes me is this pattern of adopting the trademarks of these totalitarian societies. So, I mean, what is the first thing the Red Guard does? You know, they go after all the intellectuals like Louis. What is the first thing? You know, Stalin killed them by the tens of thousands. The Ayatollah killed all these intellectuals. In North Korea, that's what they do. I mean, like, so that's what we want to do. We want to be on the, like, first we're going to kill everybody who went to college.
Well, actually, though, I will say that for the first time, I got a text message from my son last night saying that Louis Gohmert actually does get it, that he actually admired Louis Gohmert for coming out and saying, mamas, don't let your children grow up to go to Stanford and Yale law schools. My son says he liked that because he went to Yale law school. So there's a whole bunch of Yale law school alumni, whatever, who are extremely excited about Louis Gohmert. Okay, so let me throw out a couple of other names. It's not just the intellectuals that are being shoved aside. It's watching how intellectuals have accommodated themselves to this new era. And I know that you and I both hang upon the words of that renowned wordsmith Hugh Hewitt, who tweeted out earlier this morning. He's talking about this Professor Carlin, who made the sort of bad wordplay about Barron and Barron. And he said, Professor Carlin's non-apology just dug the hole deeper, igniting a third, fourth, and fifth round of scrutiny, and guaranteeing her long career will be remembered for an outburst of metaphorically bared teeth and snarling eyes.
I know.
That's
the whole, apparently there is a conspiracy of well-educated, angry women out to get Donald Trump. I look at someone like you, it just sort of breaks my heart. I just, I thought I knew these people.
Yeah.
I feel this way about so many people I worked for who are in office now in Washington. It's like, I thought I knew these people.
Yeah.
And they've just become different. I think the only answer is I didn't know them.
Well, that's right.
I don't think people change.
Yeah, power, I think, reveals rather than changes necessarily. Yeah. I did think that I described this on Twitter as performative outrage. And, of course, he's not alone. This comment about, the president can name his son Barron, but he can't make him a baron, which is sort of like, okay, get it. It's kind of a wobbly pun, and the Trump world jumps all over that, the indignant Melania, tweet, they're raising funds on it, these angry statements. But the thing is, and I think anyone who's been around for more than 5 minutes knows that, okay, this was an unforced error. It was a bad idea. You shouldn't mention kids at all. But nobody was really outraged here. Nobody thought it was an attack on Barron. Nobody's privacy was invaded. No feelings were hurt. I mean, this is, real outrage is, genuine response to awful behavior. I don't like kids in cages and stuff. But this is just faux outrage. It's just gotcha. It's just posturing. That's all. I mean, Barron's going to be fine, right?
I mean, look, let's just go back to Donald Trump, I mean, he attacks Heidi Cruz, this extremely accomplished, well-educated woman because of her looks, and compares her to Melania. I mean, right there, you should have known everything that you needed to know about Donald Trump.
Yep.
And the idea that you can go out and play outrage card over Barron when you have your other son writing porn payoff checks while he's president to a porn star that he had sex with 10 days after Barron was born. I mean, it just is, the whole thing is just a sort of absurdity that has no touchstone in any kind of true emotion or legitimacy. And it just kind of reduces everything to the ridiculousness. So when you take it like in foreign policy, I mean, there are serious issues to be dealt with, but when you go and try to pretend that, Obama's number one ally in the Mideast was Iran, you just kind of reduce everything to gibberish and nothingness. Yeah.
But that's the goal. I mean, that's not a glitch. That's the feature, right? Is it at a certain point to make people, to distract people, to confuse people, to obfuscate, to the point where people just tune out or shrug their shoulders and say, screw it, I don't know what's true.
I think you're right. I think, Trump exists in part to validate our worst selves. Trump is the side of within us all that sort of, gets angry when someone cuts us off, the kind of quasi-road rage. Trump says, that's your best self. That's who you should really be, because that son of a bitch did cut you off, and it's that way on race. He's validated racism to a degree we haven't seen from the White House since Andrew Johnson, and it makes you feel okay about what, as a culture, we had decided were traits that were not admirable: selfishness, greed. This hatred of women that just bubbles up out of the White House like some sort of, cauldron. It's just very regrettable. And this is why he draws people like Steve Bannon, because you can say, okay, I've always felt this way. Now a president feels this way. It must be okay. It's good. It's our time.
And there's something liberating about being in the monkey cage and flinging the guano on the wall. right? I mean, just fling it around. It's like, you know, you don't have to worry about it. You don't have to apologize for anything. But, you know, it is unfortunate. And I guess I continue to be amazed, not by Donald Trump, who is exactly who we all thought he was. Anyone who professes to be surprised or learning something, I just think was not paying any attention. Again, going back to your point, what is extraordinary is the number of people who have, you know, gone along with all this. So I want to get your take on this. I want to get to your this whole all about lies, because it was all a lie. This really haunts me, and so I want to talk to you about this. But I got into an argument with Chris Matthews last night on Hardball on the pace of impeachment. And my case was that, you know, speed is not necessarily your friend. The Republicans, you know, ought to slow down a little bit just to, you know, push the subpoenas, get more evidence, build the case. Let the public catch up with the facts. Let them marinate in all of this, because Donald Trump, you know, speed is Donald Trump's friend. He counts on this dizzying cycle of news and outrage and disinformation to move past things. So when the Democrats are going, yeah, let's get this done before Christmas, so everybody forgets about it by New Year, that plays in. I think that plays into Trump's hands. Chris Matthews and others on the panel were like, no, we got to do it as quickly as possible. It's a tactical question. So you're the tactical guy. Fast or slow, do it now.
You know, I really have no feel of how impeachment's going to play out. And in part, I think, because there's a lot of stuff we still don't know that will come out if we actually have a trial. But if you go back to the Clinton timetable, they passed it in, you know, sort of toward the end of December. The trial started in January and was over something like February 7th or 8th, I think. I think the underlying dynamic of all of this, the sort of key in which impeachment is being played, is that everyone knows the outcome. You know, Trump is a gangster, and what he's been able to do is a dream of every gangster, which is to fix the jury. He's reached the jury. And for the most part, these Republicans had no sense of their constitutional responsibility, which is to look at this seriously. So you take a gangster who's got a fixed jury, they're going to do whatever they want. And that's what's amazing, is how these Republican senators have allowed themselves to just completely walk away from their duties. I mean, this is what gets me, you know. Courage isn't standing up to Donald Trump. Courage is getting out of the boat when the guy in front of you just got shot. And that's the legacy that these Republicans inherited, and Democrats. And what are they doing with it? You know, they're all just playing this transactional game that they all know Trump. 90% of these people know Trump is an idiot and isn't qualified to be president. But they go along with it for various reasons. Part of it is survival. Part of it is transactional. You know, they want to get this person appointed to the Landmark Commission. And this will be, it's not any high purpose. It's not about judges. It's about just little transactional power things. And you know, Trump understands weakness. And these Republican senators, for the most part, are proving to be very weak people. And no one desires moral tests in life. We're all just going to go out of our way to avoid them. But this Trump is a moral test, and it is here. And what I really don't understand is the sense of these. One thing you say about politicians is they have big egos, which I don't think is necessarily a bad thing in life. But how are they going to be looked at by history? I mean, history's not going to be written by Fox and Friends.
Yeah,
it
amazes me they don't think more about that.
Yeah, and these people are going to be look terrible. And we're not talking about, you know, 100 years from now. In the near future, they're going to look terrible. Because one thing, when Trump leaves office, whenever that is, the real dirt is going to come out, because all the people who know what really is happening with Trump are no longer going to have a fear of Trump or a reason to remain silent. And they're all going to go out there and tell the truth. And they're all going to try to whitewash their reputations. You know, I mean, they're all going to be Franz von Papen writing their memoir about why it was necessary for Trump. And, you know, you just have to understand.
Yeah, people need to go out and Google Franz von Papen, that analogy. because I used that, and then I thought, oh, that's too harsh, and now I'm willing to go back to it. So
listen, one of the amazing things of the modern era is that Franz von Papen's memoirs available on Kindle.
Really?
I had no idea.
Oh, okay. So
that's published in 1954. So, you know, assuming he wrote it like, you know, a couple of years before, I mean, he still is like out there rationalizing Hitler.
And it's always possible to rationalize. Yeah. So, you know, I wrote a book called, you know, How the Right Lost Its Mind, and really right after, and still in the shock of the Trump victory. And one of the things I tried to wrestle with was he the logical, inevitable culmination of the Republican Party? Was he a black swan event? Did he reflect a, you know, pre-existing condition, pre-existing dysfunction? And you've taken a long look at the same question with this book, and I want to talk about this. The book is It Was All a Lie, How the Republican Party Became Donald Trump, which to me is still something that I go back and forth in the various explanations, and I cannot wait to read your book on this, which is coming out in May. So I want to dive into all of this, because I'm looking at the description here. This is not a book about how Donald Trump hijacked the Republican Party and changed it into something else. Stevens, the most successful Republican political operative of his generation, shows how Trump is, in fact, the natural outcome of five decades of hypocrisy and self-delusion dating all the way back to the civil rights legislation of the early 1960s. Can you hear me wincing as I'm reading this? So, Stuart, I want to talk about that in just a moment. But first, here's a word from our sponsor. Our sponsor today is NetSuite.com. Look, if you don't know your numbers, you don't know your business. But the problem growing businesses have, the problem that keeps them from knowing their numbers, is their hodgepodge of business systems. They have one system for accounting, another one for sales, another one for inventory, and so on. It's just a big inefficient mess, taking up too much time and too many resources, and that hurts the bottom line. So, introducing NetSuite by Oracle, the business management software that handles every aspect of your business in an easy-to-use cloud platform, giving you the visibility and control you need to grow. With NetSuite, you save time, money, and unneeded headaches by managing all of your sales, finance, accounting, orders, and HR instantly right from your desktop or phone. And that's why NetSuite is the world's number one cloud business system. And right now, NetSuite is offering you valuable insights with a free guide, 7 key strategies to grow your profits at netsuite.com/bulwark. That's netsuite.com/bulwark to download your free, completely free guide, 7 key strategies to grow your profits. netsuite.com/bulwark. Okay, so we are back with Stuart Stevens, who is described as one of the most successful political operatives of his generation, who has now written this new, unflinching and deeply personal account of how his party became what it is today. And, you know, as I think I mentioned before, I mean, I tried to rationalize it in 2016 as this was sort of a one-time event, that you had this unnatural succubus comes in and takes over what was otherwise a flawed but basically rational and decent political party. But over time, as you watch the Republican Party transform itself, you have to say this had to be here the whole time. So what is it that we missed? I mean, do you are you haunted by that idea that there were things that were going on that you recognized but didn't understand or didn't call out?
Yeah, I'm totally haunted by it, which is why I wrote this book. You know, in 2016, a lot of people were wrong about Donald Trump, but I really think it's hard to find somebody who is more wrong than me. And when I didn't think he'd win the primary, I didn't think he'd win the general. And when I look back at that and look at notes I did and things I said, it was all a lot of just like, I don't want to believe this. You know, I don't want to believe that this party that I helped elect all these people for all these years, you know, all these nights stayed up late, all these missed holidays, all these battles we fought were to deliver Donald Trump. That surely these people I knew to be decent and good people who would put America first before partisanship would see that Donald Trump, who is who he always is, as you say, there is no secret here. There is no transformation with Donald Trump. He is what he is. that this person represented everything that would make a mockery of the Republican Party. That we could disagree on issues, this issue, that issue, but we would have said 3 years, 4 years ago, that what are the principles of the Republican Party? Well, let's go through them. Character counts, personal responsibility, strong on Russia. The deficit is key, fiscal sanity. Pro-immigration. Ronald Reagan announced in front of the Statue of Liberty. His last speech in office was an ode to immigrants, that we would be a big tent party, that our failures had been not to, of being able to invite more people, that we have to work on that, that that is a goal for us. We would have said all of those things. Now, we may disagree on whether or not we're going to vote for this legislation, but that's the that was the tissue that held together the Republican Party. And all of those, it's not just that they've been abandoned, but we've all gone the other way. So we're now the character doesn't count party. We're now the deficit doesn't matter party. We're now the Russia is our friend party. We're the pro-Putin party. We're the pro-kill journalist party. We're the party where individual responsibility is to be a sucker. Because it's never your fault. Never. And if you admit something's your fault, that's weakness. And that's who the party is now.
So was it all, so your title is It's All a Lie. But I'll tell you, I mean, when I said those things, I thought they were true.
Yeah, me too. And I worked for people that I thought, and some of them did. I just look at the Republican Party as a larger entity, as an organization. And I think if you go back to the post-World War II history of the Republican Party, there was always sort of two elements competing in a broad sense. There was a element that was stone-cold racist. And when William Buckley entered the intellectual discourse about the Republican Party, he was a stone-cold racist. He later saw the error of his ways and wrote about it quite eloquently. But, I mean, let's don't forget, the first book Buckley wrote was God, Man, and Yale. The second book was this impassioned defense he wrote with his brother-in-law, Brent Rozell, of McCarthyism. So when we look back now at Trump and we sort of get all misty-eyed about the intellectual days of William Buckley, we should remember, like, those were pretty dark days. And, you know, you had Eisenhower, who hated McCarthy, was frustrated with Republicans' inability to deal with McCarthy. And there were always these two elements. And, you know, all the presidential campaigns I worked in, like in the Bush campaign, you know, we saw this. We saw these two elements. But we believe that the party's destiny was to be a broader party and that our failures were to achieve that. But aspirationally, that is what we wanted to be. And not just for political reasons, but because it was a moral imperative that if you were going to represent and be the party to represent this big, loud, contradictory country, constantly growing, constantly reinventing itself, that you had to embrace that. Now, that's just all thrown out the window.
But, I mean, it did feel that way, and many of us believed that and felt that the arc of the party was very much in that direction, that the future of the party was people like the Jack Kemps of the world rather than the Pat Buchanans of the world, that, you know, Paul Ryan was the future of the party rather than the, you know, the this maybe the Sarah Palin, just to throw her name in randomly. So, I mean, obviously now, I mean, it's hard, you know, to take family values, fiscal responsibility serious. But let's talk about racism for a second.
Yeah, because I think race it's always original sin.
Well, but my argument would have been, and I'm not sure that I'm obviously right about this, you know, that, you know, racism and the race card were always part of the Republican right-wing movement. But I thought of it as a recessive gene. That could be controlled, that the better angels of our nature were in the ascendancy, but clearly that was a miscalculation.
Yeah. I mean, look, the great failure of the Republican Party, whatever you believe politically, just in a poli-sci sense, is African Americans. So, you know, 1956, Eisenhower gets 39% of African Americans. 1964, it's down to 7%, and it never comes back. So all these years that I was working in the Republican Party, there was sort of this truism that was put out there that the problem with Republicans is we just didn't know how to talk to African Americans. And there was this whole cottage industry of African American consultants who were hired to teach those of us who weren't African American, who were Republican, who were working in campaigns, how to talk to African Americans. That was all bullshit. It wasn't that African Americans didn't understand us. They understood us just fine. It's what we were saying. It was not how we were saying. It was the policy. And when you had this contradiction here that always existed in the party that I never really tried to resolve, that on the one hand, we say sort of the Reaganism, you know, the scariest words are the federal government's here to help. And then there was this whole group the country that saw the federal government as a more positive force. I mean, it was a federal government that sent troops to the University of Mississippi, where I grew up, 30,000 troops to integrate one African American. It was a federal government that passed civil rights actions that most Southern politicians, Democrat and Republican, and there were more Democrats then, opposed. It was the federal government was a force for good. And we never could sort of square that circle. And African Americans got that. And we couldn't go around, same with Hispanics. So there's been this whole truism, Hispanics really should be Republicans because they're conservative culturally. And in the Bush campaign, you know, we got up to 41% in the reelect of Hispanics, but George Bush really felt this passionately and did believe this. And it wasn't just a game to him. And there is a whole different relationship in Texas with Hispanics and conservatism. It's more embedded in the culture, Tex-Mex culture. I mean, even Ted Cruz gets, you know, close to 40% of Hispanics. But it was a rejection of that, and I think that Hispanics see that. And, you know, we used to do well with Asian Americans. We used to do great with Asian Americans. And it's not like the party's out there attacking Asian Americans. It's just, they get it, though. That when you send the signal that if you're not white, you're not welcome. I think it doesn't really matter if you're Hispanic, you're Black, you're Asian American, you're not white. And what has happened is the Republican Party has been validated now as a white grievance party. And
I just don't see how they come back from that.
We never came back from Goldwater with African Americans. And for the life of me, I don't see how Hispanics... I mean, we weren't out attacking African Americans. They just voted against the Voting Rights Act and voted against a lot of civil rights legislation in the Great Society. We're out there attacking Hispanics now. So I don't know, how likely is it you're going to forget that, like, a president of the United States called your father-in-law a rapist? I don't know. I kind of think that's going to maybe stick with you.
For a couple of generations. Okay, so here's one of the arguments you make. That when a party stands for nothing, it's only natural it will be taken over by the loudest and angriest voices in the room. So let's just go back to pre-Trump. We were having a discussion about whether the Republican Party stood for anything. Somebody might argue, I might argue, that the difference between the Democratic Party and the Republican Party is the Republican Party was much more ideological, much more based on these principles. The Democratic Party was a sort of disorderly coalition of power and interest groups, but that we really believed those things, which is why we had so many guardians of ideological purity on Fox News or on the internet. Or on talk radio, that if you were, you came out in favor of tax increases or soft on immigration, you were a rhino. And suddenly, though, this is part of the disorientation, because those principles were very loudly articulated and were very loudly enforced up until the moment Donald Trump came down the escalator. So what did we get wrong there too? Because, I mean, I agree with your conclusion that clearly what we've seen exposed is that this is a party that doesn't really believe in anything, that it knows what it's against and who it hates, doesn't know what it's for, and therefore, you know, has, you know, become taken, you know, it was taken over by the loudest and the angriest voices. But so where did we get it wrong, or where did I get it wrong thinking that the Republican Party was, in fact, the party of ideas?
I come to one conclusion, you know. You look at life, people don't abandon deeply held beliefs in 3 years, absent any sort of new information that comes in. And when you do abandon them, it only means one thing, that you never really deeply held them. We never believed this stuff. We just used them as weapons to attack Democrats. And they were convenient to think that we'd like to believe, like family values. I mean, that's kind of like a nice thing you want to believe. But now we've got a guy, you know, who's in the Oval Office is writing hush money to porn stars. And that's fine. That's great. That doesn't matter. It can only mean one thing. Look, if you're a lifelong vegetarian and, you know, somebody says, look, I'm going to give you $200,000 to start a steak restaurant, but like you have to eat steaks every day. You go, that's great. Like probably you really didn't believe that you were like, there was much to vegetarianism. And that's what's happened here.
Yeah.
I mean, if you go back to after the Romney campaign, the party, and I think Reince Priebus gets credit for this, went through this so-called autopsy analyzing what was wrong with it. And the conclusion,
which is a remarkable document to read now.
It reads, if you go back and read these things, the same, go back and read George Bush's acceptance speech in 2000 that Michael Gerson wrote. It reads like an artifact from a lost civilization. You know, it's like studying Mayans or something. Who are these people? We're talking about compassion. We're talking about humility. We're talking about giving. We're talking about appealing to our better angels. This is all completely antithetical to what the Republican Party is now. So and George Bush, as that person, I mean, couldn't get 15% in the Republican primary now nationally. He wouldn't have a chance. So I think, look, the test is whether or not you believe these things. I mean, it's that old thing about character. It's what you do when people aren't looking. So what I get is that, like with family values, like we never believed that stuff. And now Trump has given us permission to admit that we never believed in it.
And because, yeah, I mean, well, that's right. I agree. So the book, your book description, which I cannot wait to read, you know, that it is described as a candid and often lacerating mea culpa. Stevens is not asking for pity or forgiveness. He is simply telling us what he has seen firsthand. He helped to create the modern party that kneels before a morally bankrupt con man. I get accused of this as well, that even though I've been, you know, railing against Donald Trump now for 5 years, or 4 years now, and yet people say, well, you built this. You are responsible for this. And of course, my instinct, of course, is to say, well, that's bullshit. You know, I not only didn't build it, I fought against it. I did everything possible to do it. And then there are those moments where you sit back and you go, okay, wow, did I build a little bit of that? Did I do that? I mean, and so let's go back. So in your book, I mean, what is your mea culpa? What did you do?
The opening sentence in the book is blame me. I mean, I was deep in the machine. I made thousands of ads about fiscal responsibility. I made thousands of ads attacking Democrats on cultural issues. I mean, that was the thing. You know, we always argue that culture matters because culture is more important than any single piece of legislation, that culture is what defines a society. And we've now decided that culture doesn't matter. I was a guy, reasonably well educated, not an idiot. I was working in this and I went along with it. And I should have seen it. I mean, I should have realized that the part that we thought was, as you put it very well, a recessive gene was not a recessive gene. It was just lying there waiting to be dominant. I can't say like these other guys did this. I mean, I went out there and, you know, I helped elect over half Republican senators and congressmen in the country, half the states of the country.
Wisconsin from blue to red. When people on Twitter say, well, you know, Charlie Sykes, he helped elect Scott Walker. Well, guilty as charged.
Yeah.
I know these memes. I know the narratives. And doesn't it feel sometimes like a bizarre world, though, that you see some of the things that you had put out there sort of come back in a slightly, well, not a slightly, in the cartoonish way that they've been Trumpified? Do you know what I'm talking about here?
Yeah, listen.
You recognize it all, right? I mean, you recognize all the lines.
And one of the more depressing aspects of Trumpism is that it proves that Paul Krugman was right. He made all the wrong people right. But we failed. There was a moment So if you go back to this autopsy, right? So that was posed not just as a political document, but as something that was necessary for the country, for a party to be a governing party. So then you get Trump, he runs. Trump comes out for a Muslim ban, which is against the Constitution, is against everything that we said as Republicans, a religious test, which is all a Muslim ban is. I mean, I always say, like, what if, like, Cat Stevens, you know, the singer who became a Muslim, showed up at Heathrow and said, well, you know, I'm not a Muslim anymore, I'm a Quaker. What are you going to do, like, ask him, like, trivia questions about, like, Penn? I mean, I don't even know what Quaker, it's just, it's a religious test. So what should have happened, Reince Priebus should have said, look, we should have treated him like we treated Todd Akin when he said this crazy stuff about rape in the Missouri Senate race in 2012. She said, look, we can't stop you from running, but we're not going to back you. And if Trump still won the primary, Reince Priebus should have said, look, this isn't the vision I had for the party. The party's spoken. I respect that. I resign. And he'd be a hero now, instead of a guy sitting in the audience of Dancing in the Stars cheering, you know, Sean Spicer. And I don't understand why it wasn't done more. I mean, everybody I know who's a congressman and a senator, and I know a lot of them, complain constantly about the job. It's not a great gig in a lot of ways. So what's so bad about being like an ex-congressman or senator who left the party or didn't run or got defeated because he stood for something? These are people who are going to be okay in life.
Yeah, but I get it because it's not just the job. It's your entire social world. It's the tribe. It's being liked. It's look, the reality is you and I think, are probably alike in the sense that we're contrarians. That, you know, I'm an only child, so I'm used to not playing and working well with others. But I do understand that people want to get along with people. They want to have professional networks. They want to be relevant. If you're a professional conservative, you know this, in Washington, D.C., and you became anti-Trump, you better have a pretty good side gig. Otherwise, you were going to be excommunicated.
You know, I started this highly successful Republican consulting firm in the early 90s, and I left it this year.
What if you relied on that to pay your mortgage, to put your kids through college? Would you be thinking, oh man, I can't do it?
Listen, I think there's a lot of people working on the Hill. If you're working on the Hill and you have a family and it's hard to get jobs and the person you're working for is a Trump person, I get that. I give those people a total pass. What I don't get, if you look at, you know, the net worth of most of these congressmen and senators, they're going to be fine. And most of them could walk into other jobs. They're not doing this for economic pressure. They're not doing this for their families. They're not doing this to put their kids through school. They're not doing it to build a better life for, you know, another generation. They're doing it for selfish reasons. And I don't have respect for that. It's just cowardness. That's all it is. I mean, we can kind of sugarcoat it. We can do this. But it's just cowardness. And I just don't understand how hard it is it to stand up to Donald Trump. I mean, look, I love being part of a tribe. I mean, first of all, it was easy. You know, the secret to success as a political consultant is to work for people who are going to win anyway. And if you start winning, you get really good clients who are probably going to win anyway, so you keep winning. So, you know, every 4 years, you have a chance to work in a presidential race if you want to, do a lot of Senate races, a lot of governor's races. You have a network of your friends. It's comfortable. And I just couldn't do it anymore. I mean, I just couldn't wake up and lie anymore. And that's what it had to be. It had to be a lie. You had to say, well, this isn't really who the Republican Party is. It's going to revert to something else. But I can't say that. It's just, I don't see any reason to believe that's true. I'd like it to be true. It breaks my heart to write this book. I mean, look, to look back and see something you worked 25, 30 years to build and realize it's so depressing.
Well, but it isn't. I mean, and that's part of the thing that I've gone through as well, which is look back and say, so if I say these things, if I take this direction, am I basically saying that I wasted 20 years of my life, or that I was wrong? Yes. Or that the 20 years of my life were a mistake. That is as hard as the risking your job, I think. Is risking that whole sense of who you are and what you spent two decades working on.
Well, I don't know any other conclusion.
You don't get that back.
I have this idea that, if we believed in personal responsibility, we have to start with personal responsibility. And I feel personally responsible. I can't speak to other people. I can see why other people did. But I do think, I think I should have seen this. And I don't think it was that hidden. I think we just chose to ignore it. I think I chose to ignore it for reasons that, are not particularly admirable. Because it was easy, because, I was making money, because I didn't want to think about it. So, if we're going to go back to personal responsibility, it seems like it has to start individually. So, yeah, I take personal responsibility for it. I don't know what else to do. I can't undo it. Yeah. I can only start now.
So are you still in touch with your old boss, Mitt Romney?
Yeah, mostly just on a kind of personal level, friends, family.
Yeah. I mean, a nation turns its lonely eyes to Mitt Romney alone. I don't know how many times I've written in the Bulwark or in various places the headline, Mitt Romney alone again. I mean, he's it right now. He's aware of that.
I would never speak for Mitt, and I never, ask him these questions. I get the sense, though, just from what I read publicly, that he actually takes his responsibility as a senator, as the Constitution so describes. And he looks at this, that there's a good chance that there will be impeachment passed by the House, and he'll be a juror. And he's going to look at this as a juror. He's been a juror before. He has a law degree. It's not... all these senators would be bounced from a jury pool in a heartbeat.
Yeah, you would think so.
They'll go, hey, look, I'm for that guy. I think he's good. It's okay. I don't care that he, stole that purse. They go, no, dude, you're not going to be on the jury.
My favorite part about the Senate impeachment trial?
What?
Is the senators don't get to talk. They have to sit there and listen.
Yes.
And I'm not sure some of the things that I've heard from the Trump White House, whether Trump fully understood that you won't have, Ted Cruz and Lindsey Graham waving their arms on the floor of the Senate, coming up with their latest, bat guana theory that is out there. So, yeah, it's going to be interesting to see whether, how that plays out for them and whether, how many of them actually take it seriously. I have to tell you, of course, I'm not an optimist.
Oh, no, I'm completely opposite. Look, we're a very personality-driven country. If you go back to the Watergate hearings, what do we remember? We remember personalities more than specific points of law. We remember Fred Thompson, made him a star. I think that the success and failure on a political sense of impeachment, it's going to be a lot of who ends up being the voices and faces representing both sides. And that, I think, will tell the tide a lot of how the country reacts to it. I mean, People Magazine is more successful than Foreign Affairs for a reason. People care about people. So, I hope the Democrats have somebody who is likable and can present a good case in a cogent way.
So the book is... It was all a lie, how the Republican Party became Donald Trump, by Stuart Stevens. And so I have two things to do today. I have to pre-order your book, which is coming out in May, and I have to go to Kindle to look up the memoirs of Franz von Papen.
Yes.
Which is amazing that actually exists.
Really,
Stuart Stevens, thank you so much for spending so much time with us today.
Great talking with you, buddy.
Hey, I appreciate it. And thank you for listening to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we'll do this all over again.